and the disease is not a great leveller, the consequences of which everyone, rich or poor, suffers the same. This is a myth which needs debunking.
I represent one of the hardest hit communities in the hardest hit city in this country, Queens, New York. 13 dead in a night in Elmhurst Hospital alone. Our community's reality is this country's future.
It's Friday, the 10th of April, 2020, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration at the University of Amsterdam, and I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran. Now, when we started off this special series on the COVID-19 crisis and the politics of that, I didn't know in working with Abby Steele that I was working with a soothsayer of sorts. Abby may not know this herself, but when we spoke last week, she was specifically drawing our listeners' attention to the idea that the key thing that's going to emerge out of this crisis was the fact that vulnerable populations, the vulnerability of specific populations, was going to become more and more evident as the crisis unfolded. And this last week, I think that's come fully into view with unemployment in the United States and also the exposure of the African-American population to this form of vulnerability, with the discussion around Boris Johnson's own sickness and the differences being revealed in a BBC interview about this notion that there's somehow a leveling dimension to this this virus, but that being put, you know, a lot of people pushing back on that notion, saying it's not a leveling process, it's actually really revealing inequalities. And so Abby, I had no idea you had such a prescient vision of the future.
Well, I'm not sure I do either. I had no idea either. I think other people have been saying that. I don't think that was an original remark on my part. A lot of people who, of course, pay attention to vulnerable populations have been really, wringing their hands over how this is going to unfold. And even from our very first guest, I think she was also talking quite a lot about these sort of undocumented migrants in South Africa and how difficult it will be for them potentially, right, to access levels of healthcare that they may need. So we continue to worry about it.
One of the ones that I've been really saddened by, but somewhat amazed by, is at the moment this began and the social distancing measures began, people who were paying attention to gender and domestic violence were on it, saying this is going to be a huge crisis. And unfortunately, they were completely right, right?
Yeah, I think that is a huge dimension of it. And I'm just in awe of the people who work in this sector and all the work they've been doing to try to mitigate that kind of exposure to women and children, primarily in abusive situations, and all of the kind of creative workarounds for that, like, you know, having a burner phone available to women who they already know or suspect are vulnerable, so they can call or send like a code word text message if they're in real danger. Mm. I think some of these solutions are just amazing, and I hope that they are working for enough people, because it must be such a scary time for them.
You're also going to tell us a little bit about the donut model that...
Oh yeah, the donut that model.
You were tweeting about yesterday.
I saw that this there was a Guardian article about how the city of Amsterdam is going to be adopting or has already adopted a donut model of governance, I guess. And this is an idea developed by an economist at Oxford who I've never heard of this model before, but she is promoting this idea, or has been since her book in 2017, which was detailing this approach about healthy cities, that you want to keep... how to keep things in balance, it seems to be. So how do you not overdevelop areas that will then threaten the climate or the environment and do sort of damage, but it's also seems to incorporate things like human rights and human welfare. sort of in tandem or sort of offsetting economic growth. And so that apparently the city of Amsterdam has adopted this tool. I guess I would say it's a tool. I've never heard of it before, so I don't really get it. But I think, okay, you know, this seems to be a new and different approach than just how do we keep the economy running and growing, sort of without taking into account the negative externalities of that economic growth model. So it's sort of like, okay, if we're going to do this, let's do this. Let's try other ideas and see what implications they would have for policy. So yeah, I don't know. Let's see.
I'm wondering whether our listeners are in the same position as me, because like during that whole discussion, I was distracted by this, like, you know, underlying desire to eat donuts, right? Like that's the first thing that makes me think about. And with that in mind, like, I'm going to segue to like our next guest, who's like from the home of food in Singapore. Jia Ye is
nice segue.
is going to really talk about inequality today in and how that is playing into the COVID crisis from her perspective. Jia, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Darshan and Abby, for this invitation. I've actually been looking forward to it all day. At the same time, I'm trying to really keep a pace with developments here. As we last talked, I think what's emerging in terms of the current crisis here in Singapore is really the issue of dormitories, migrant worker dormitories, becoming these hotbeds of passing the infection on. Just yesterday, 2 days ago, what day is it? The days don't make sense anymore. Just yesterday, we reached an all-time high of 285 cases in a day. And the vast majority of this comes from migrant worker dormitories. These are large purpose-built dormitories that house tens of thousands of low-wage male migrants, predominantly. The men who are living there are usually from Bangladesh or India, and mainland China as well, working in shipyard and construction industries. As with these numbers, my suspicion is that it is a conservative number. My sense is that now the spotlight is on these large-scale dormitories that are usually self-contained. So they've got basketball courts, they've got gymnasiums, supermarkets, hairdressers,
they have to have a food court.
Yeah, yeah. They've got a food court. They've actually also got these huge kitchens where migrants cook their dinners after they come home from work. So there are lots of sort of, I guess, shared spaces within these dormitories where, you know, in normal, better times, migrants can have a sort of space for community building, I suppose. But of course, you know, that is becoming quite problematic now. So I do think that this is a conservative estimate, because these are only, now the spotlight is on these huge dormitories, but we've actually got also smaller dormitories that are usually built at the work site, that they seem to be under the radar at this point.
I'm just wondering, could you explain to us, I mean, a lot of your work has been based on these workers and your research in the dormitories themselves, and I know that you've got research assistants working there at the moment. What, if anything, could, you know, how does social distancing play out in a context like this? A lot of the recent commentary is about social distancing is something that rich people in developed countries can do, but in this context, how does it actually play out, and how are those policies playing out?
You know, we live in spectacular times, right, where work from home, stay at home, social distancing is very much the civil way to be. Which of course begs the question, when we're talking about inequality, what about, you know, for the people whom this is not possible, right? For a lot of these migrants, home is a shared room between 12 to 20 people in bunk beds. In that sense, I think social distancing, I think, remains a spatial privilege that is elusive to them, right? Yesterday when I was on a bike ride, a solitary bike ride, I passed by groups of men, these migrant workers, still carrying out their work on the side of the road, in teams. I mean, the nature of their work is such that not only is it segregated from the rest of the population here, the nature of their work is such that they do work in teams. And the majority of them did not wear masks. I also am still seeing men being ferried to and from the work site, sitting on the back of trucks. This is, you know, the primary way in which they are transported from their dormitories to their work and back. And I still see them sitting at the back of trucks with very little to no distance, right?
I'm wondering. I mean, what you're describing sounds really surprising. Of course, unfortunate that it seems like there's not more proactive response, but it also seems really surprising given how strong Singapore's response was in the beginning. It seemed like, oh, they were so proactive, they were so involved in pinpointing infection and tracking. And then in the sector, I guess you could say, I wonder why isn't the government saying, yeah, we have to stop this work, or we have to figure out a plan to give people more space, even in these kind of camps, or send people home, or what are they doing?
That's a very helpful question, because I think, well, a couple of things. I think, first of all, this tells us that as the story of COVID-19 is unfolding, it is very closely related to this other story that is also unfolding, which is that of inequality, right? And I think these past 10 days or so, we're seeing that rising quite urgently to the top in Singapore. You're right in that, you know, in the earlier days of managing the virus, Singapore did, you know, I think the bureaucrats did do quite a good job of responding to the impacts of the virus. And I think in general, actually, Singaporeans are not freaking out in general. You know, there will be a couple of spikes, right? A few weekends of freak-outness. usually just before or following our Prime Minister's speech on national television about whether we're moving to code orange or you know, not quite code red. Usually there will be a rush at the supermarkets. There was toilet paper gate where supermarket shelves were wiped clean of toilet paper. But that sort of died down quite fast. And I think this is because, you know, the country's leaders were very sort of, they seem to be quite forthcoming and communicative to the population. And for those of us who are doing online grocery shopping, we also saw how quickly these providers responded to the crisis as well. So I think in general, for a lot of us, we probably feel safer here than our counterparts elsewhere. But I think, yeah, in the past 10 days or so, I mean, you know, NGOs have for a very long time, NGOs in Singapore have for a long time been raising the issue of what constitutes adequate accommodation, in scare quotes, for these migrant workers, right? So I think it is, in a sense, it is frightening, but at the same time, not entirely surprising that the virus is now sort of hitting some of the most vulnerable, I think, populations amongst us.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, do you foresee the government taking more proactive responses tailored to the migrant workers' situation?
Yeah, I'm struggling to keep up with the changes, to tell you the truth. And actually, you know, aside from the changing regulations with regards to the migrants, the regulations are also changing very quickly for all of Singapore, as COVID-19 develops, right?
Could you describe some of those?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the bigger ones would be the change in discourse about masks. At first, I think in the earlier days, it was, you know, only wear a mask if you are not feeling well. No need to wear a mask if you are healthy. But now, of course, it is, yeah, okay, yeah, wear a mask. In fact, we will distribute reusable masks for you, right? Also, I think...
I've never spent that much time in Singapore, but like in Southeast Asia generally, and Southeast Asians seem to like their masks, right? Like it's not a socially awkward thing to wear one in public.
I would say Hong Kong and Taiwan probably have, it's much more common in Hong Kong and Taiwan to be wearing masks, even during pre-COVID days. It is much more the norm now. It is very quickly emerging as civil behavior to wear masks when you are out in public. And I think
Can you describe that in the Singaporean context a little bit more, because like this notion of what civil behavior is it's a little bit different, right, to what we would think of as civil behavior, right? Like in the way in which civility is connected to being responsible in public space.
Yeah, so this is, I think, shaped by a couple of factors, right? So first of all, I think the civility in Singapore is very much shaped by government discourse, right? The state tells you, you know, this is what it means to be kind in public. You return your trays after eating. We have to respect our multiracial, multi-faith, multicultural sort of composition. So you need to be cognizant that these utensils are not halal, for example. You must not bring durian onto public transport. But I think civility is also shaped by our sheer density. So much of public life is far denser than many other places. Yeah. Just yesterday when I was wheeling my bike out for my little ride, I was in the elevator and, you know, I live on the 20th floor, so it's a long way down. but you know, the elevator stopped at a couple of floors and I had to tell the guys, you know, sorry, please don't come in. There's no way I can move. So for us, it's 1 meter distance. I think in New Zealand, I think it's 3 meters.
Wow.
So I think 3 meters maybe is a little bit difficult in Singapore, you know. So I think what we consider civil...
I can see the meme now of people trying to work this out in elevators, right? Like, how do you do that? What is the ideal distribution?
Yeah, I mean, in some bigger elevators, there are little squares that are marked out in tape that tells you, okay, this is where you can stand. Stand within your box! Yeah, and I think the notion of civility is changing quite rapidly, because the rules and regulations are changing so rapidly, right? So ever since we talked, we've been on, an ever sort of increasing array of what we cannot do. So when we last talked just a few days ago, it was still okay to go for a run at the neighborhood stadium, for example. Now that is not okay anymore.
I was going to ask what we heard about in the very beginning was how effective Singapore's contact tracing was. And I wonder if they're still attempting to do that, even though the infections have increased, or what are the tools that the government is using to try to... or have they just kind of let that go now? Can you give us an update on that one?
Yeah. So contact tracing in Singapore is very, you know, the ins and outs of it remain a bit mysterious to me. But as far as I know, the army and the police have been mobilized to manage contact tracing. The army and the police have also been mobilized in these large-scale dormitories in the last 48 hours or so to manage the migrants within these spaces. We are, you know, contact tracing...
Is that common? As a move in Singapore, do you see the army deployed in civilian operations ever or regularly?
No, I wouldn't say regularly. I mean, surveillance in Singapore is, I don't know, maybe it's so much a part of the ecosystem that I don't even see it anymore. but no, to answer that particular question, Darshan, no, I would not say so. What was I saying? Contact tracing is also taking place, actually at the university. Faculty was also aiding in contact tracing. For a while, when classes were still on, we, at the start of every class, were supposed to take a picture of the whole class, and people were not supposed to change their seats. So we were given instructions that you are supposed to take these photos and keep these photos for 30 days before you delete them. So that's within campus. But I think there's also the Trace Together app that the Singapore government developed to sort of record where you've been, so that if you have been in contact with any known cases, you can be quickly sort of isolated, I suppose.
And uptake on that app was voluntary, but I think in large volumes, right? Like people subscribe to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's voluntary, and it's funny. I mean, in Singapore, people are, you know, have been calling on the state to do more, you know, pass more regulations, go for a complete lockdown, which, you know, I think is, again, not that surprising in the Singaporean context. Coming back to the dormitory issue, the state's response has also been one of keeping the migrant workers within the dormitories, where they're not allowed, you know, I think some of the dormitories that have the largest number of cases, workers are not allowed to leave, nor are they allowed to enter. Which, of course, you know, this is sort of cruise ship
or prison management,
right? And I...
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's very sort of, it just, you know, I'm just saying cruise ship because it's reminding me of the Diamond Princess. Keep them there so that they're not infecting the rest of us. But of course, they will reach a point where its infection has, you know, sort of swept through the entire dorm.
I'm wondering if you could like it comment on the more recent developments, the way in which Singapore is dealing with it in light of, I guess, its history. I mean, I can't think of a city that's been more shaped by the issue of public health, housing, you know, and the idea of controlling the mobility and interaction of its population than Singapore. And also, there's the more recent history of having to deal with SARS and other Southeast Asian, East Asian crises, and how that's played into its current efforts.
Yep, and I think a lot of the earlier efforts by the state, I think, comes from these, I guess, in a sense, the lessons learned from SARS, because Singapore was also one of the hotspots of SARS. So I think following that, there was a lot more protocol put in place in terms of, you know, what to do when a pandemic hits.
I mean, maybe it's difficult to judge from as an insider, actually, how, you know, that those past experiences shape what you're doing at the moment. Because I know, like, one of the narratives from the outside has been, oh, you know, Southeast Asia saw these things before and therefore was ready this time, you know, to react and respond in a different way, both in terms of policy and also in terms of populations who are, you know, had seen similar sorts of measures taken before and therefore were ready to respond.
I think I need to think about that a little bit more.
Let me give you an example, right? Like, so in the Netherlands,
we're
not ready. Like, to the whole notion of social distancing, you know, it hasn't really dropped in a way. Like, we take our kids out of school, but we let them play on the streets together, right? It's like, and the implications of that, because they're diffuse and because they're not, you know, it's not my grandma necessarily who's, you know, being threatened by this directly. We don't run it through.
Or another example, another dimension of that is that the recently the government floated the idea of having an app that sounds kind of similar. I haven't seen a good description of what they mean by this app, but my hunch would be that it would be something about, you know, a similar kind of app to know where an infected person has been retrospectively, right?
Yeah.
But of course, you know, there's just a sort of, what? Why would we do that? You know, how can we ask people to do that? And the sort of concerns about privacy here and sort of democracy and transparency, and but especially privacy, it's like we don't know how to have a conversation about balancing privacy with the collective threat that this pandemic is, right? And that the trade-offs that might need to happen between sort of individual liberties and privacy versus a state needing to implement new and uncomfortable, potentially, policies for the benefit of public health, right? This is a kind of set of conversations that we have not had until now.
Thanks for the prompt. I think so two things. I think first of all, the discourse in Singapore now, it's not so much, you know, do it for yourself. It's really protect the vulnerable populations amongst us. And vulnerable populations, in general here refers to the elderly. So one of the latest developments that I think reflects this is parents who have young children and who have been dropping their children off at their grandparents' house for childcare are no longer allowed to do that. Because you want to make sure that our seniors are not being exposed to more contact than is necessary for them. But I think the other point is that if you do violate these rules and regulations, there are fines imposed. I think the first offense is $10,000, second offense, $20,000, and or jail time.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's serious. Okay. So now it's hilarious because it's from the Western perspective, it's like, oh no, but literally someone in the health ministry here at some point said, but Asians are just obedient. So like we couldn't hope to implement some of these measures that, for example, South Korea is implementing. But then you're like, oh, but there's a $10,000 fine behind it. That's a little different than like we're just going
to
go along.
We will be obedient to the tune of $10,000. Right. I mean, but again, you know, I think it is not necessarily an Asian thing, because if you think about what New Zealand is also doing, it's pretty impressive, right? Jacinda Ardern came out and just said, you can't leave your bubble.
I think what's amazing that this has been also very revealing is that there are so many more things in common across cultures, even though like the initial interpretation of so much is this sort of cultural stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I think at the margins, of course, culture influences how we are behaving and reacting, but there's also so much more in common, not only to how individuals are responding, but how governments are responding, you know, like I think that has been
discipline and punish. Discipline and punish.
Discipline and punish. All while saying, look, we're doing this for the greater good.
Yeah.
I think there are lots of different levers, right, that governments can try to pull. And so you can be doing all of these at the same time. And I think that's normal.
Yeah.
But then to say, like, as an analyst, oh, this is the lever that's working in this place versus this is the lever, you know, in this other place. Like, I think that's probably overstated.
Right,
often.
I think going back to your earlier comment about inequality, I think, you know, what this, you know, still evolving bio crisis, if you will, is really kind of highlighting, are these latent, you know, simmering sort of differential treatment that I think, of course, a lot of urban dwellers in Singapore are up against, and And you see that not just with the male migrants who are in these dormitories, but we see that with female domestic workers as well. So in Singapore, because of our aging population and our dismal birth rate, we've got an increasing number of female domestic workers from the region, primarily from Philippines, Indonesia, Sri Lanka as well. And on the weekends, pre-COVID times, you know, on their day off, they would, you would see them in many public spaces on the Sunday. And a couple weeks ago, when I was still allowed to do field work, you know, I started seeing these Ministry of Manpower officers going to some of these, I guess, weekend enclaves to move them along, to move the women along, saying that, you know, you should not be gathering, you need to be, if you need to see your friends on your day off, you should just meet them and continue walking for the rest of the afternoon. And this, you know, this message has obviously permeated to the whole population. But I think we're still hearing, I guess, from our bureaucrats, you know, these differential treatments, right? What comes to mind is one of our ministers, you know, he said something, I think it was on one of his social media pages. He has since apologized, but in some ways his apology was a bit patchy, shall we say. But he basically said that one of the parks are very is very popular with female domestic workers on a Sunday, and his residents have been complaining for a very long time. And I quote, he said, it took a virus to move them along. And you know, this, there was uproar about this, and he semi apologized slash justified his response.
Oh, weird. A politician doesn't know how to apologize.
You mentioned uproar, like, in response to that. I mean, but can you think of, ways... I mean, because the description that you give is somewhat of, like, seamless compliance by the Singaporean population with a lot of these sort of shifting government policies and responses. But can you think of any, like, moments of pushback that you're seeing, or even, like, you know, what Setha Lowe would describe as a breakdown in public space of, like, you know, this order being disrupted at all, or... I don't know.
I mean, we do see a lot of Singaporeans feeling quite, you know, expressing a lot of sympathy for particularly the male migrants in the dormitories. We do hear a lot of Singaporeans wanting to... whether it is donating money so that the migrants can have better food at the dormitories during this time, or donating money so that the migrants can have telephone cards to keep communicating with the family and friends back home. So I don't think that's necessarily resistance or pushback, but it's very much sort of this idea that, you know, we should do something to help this particular vulnerable group. But there is also a lot of sort of enforcement, right? Like, do not be venturing out and eating in public, otherwise I will take your photo and shame you on my social media.
You mean other citizens will shame you?
Yeah. So,
or the,
you know,
government.
This person eating at the hawker center, but they're really not allowed to be eating there. I'm gonna take a photo and post it on my Facebook wall.
Okay. So on that note, I both of you have given me, and it's a difficult dilemma, like two perfect titles potentially for this podcast, and I have to weigh up which one I'm going to use, like Asians Are Obedient or Discipline and Punish, right? Like I don't know which one amongst those to choose. But on that note,
I don't think you should go with a sarcastic title. Like, I'm not sure that everyone would instantly be
I
able
might
to
not
spot
go
that
for either of those. But thank you, Gia. Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our Twitter feed, on Facebook. We also have a blog where you can access us. We're also now available on Spotify. If you have an idea about a story that we should feature or a guest that we should have on the show, if you want to come on the show, get in touch with us at imes@uva.nl.